Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll have music and conversation with Adriana Marie. She'll be closing out this year's Blue Jay Jazz Festival, August 24th. We'll start tonight with more on a two-person art exhibit currently on display at the Gresham Art Gallery on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College.
You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm Rick Dulock. Andrew K. Thompson will display some of his art in a two-person exhibition at the Clara and Alan Gresham Art Gallery on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College. The name of the exhibit, Gray is the Color of Theory. It opens August 23rd. You can find out more at valleycollege.edu/artgallery. And I'll give that web address again a little later. Andrew K. Thompson is my guest today on KVC Arts. Thanks, Andrew, for speaking with me.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So you did your undergrad work in San Francisco and then received your Master of Fine Arts at Cal State San Bernardino.
Correct.
So are you an Inland Empire native?
No, I was born and raised in Temple City, California, out by Pasadena.
Okay.
I spent 10 years in San Francisco, and then I did another 10 years in New York, prior to coming back to the Inland Empire to be closer to my family.
Okay.
And that's why I got my MFA at Cal State San Bernardino.
So you did your undergrad work in San Francisco and then all around doing art?
Correct. Yeah, I was living as an actual artist in New York, Brooklyn, of course, between 2001 and 2011. And, you know, I wanted to get my master's degree so I could start teaching and get other opportunities.
Sure. And so that's when you returned to Cal State San Bernardino.
Correct.
So now you reside in the Inland Empire. You live in Riverside?
Correct.
Excellent. Yes. And it says you studied photography in San Francisco. So is photography still your preferred media?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm very unorthodox as a photographer to many people, but photography is what I wanted to do since I was 12. It's something I've been doing since, and a lot of this work that's in this show specifically is not lens-based. In fact, it's not even darkroom-based. It's mostly chemical-based. So in that sense, I'm very much using the medium of photography, but I'm using it in a non-traditional way.
Okay. So they're going to have to come see this exhibit to find out what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Well, when did you discover that you would make your living creating things?
I don't know if it was so much a discovery, it was more of a force of will. I was an early teenager, and all I wanted to be was Macho Man Randy Savage and Salvador Dali. And so, somewhere in between, as the time has gone on, I knew I wanted to be an artist, and photography was what called me when I was young, and photography is what I dedicated myself to, with the idea that you learn the rules so that you can break them. And I've been, probably since 2011, actively breaking the rules like Miles Davis, you know. These notes are forgotten, and I'm strictly working off of instinct and intellect.
Well, when you started as a kid, you know, with photography, mm-hmm. you were doing traditional photography. What did you start shooting with?
It was a Nikon of some sort. It was my brother. My brother's 6 years older than I am. And at the time, he had gone to school at Pasadena City College, had taken some classes, gave me a really rudimentary introduction to it. Uh-huh. And I had a broken leg at the time, and I photographed my friend skateboarding. And that was it. And from skateboarding, I also photographed BMX when I was younger in the late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
And I can go on and on. I did a lot of photography, and I still do.
You were kind of doing more or less sports photography then.
Yeah, I started out with sports photography, eventually got into portrait photography. I worked at Expressly Portraits for a while. That's where I was learning how to print, learning how to expose using medium format cameras and color. I then started going to college, and that's when I started studying photography.
Ah.
First at PCC, then at the Academy of Art in San Francisco. And during my time at the Academy, I felt constricted by what I would like to call the photographic dogma, this idea that it has to be the perfect zone system, uncropped, all the bright grays and blacks, you know, and this whole, like, Ansel Adams idea or Henri Cartier-Bresson idea that, like, this is what a good picture looks like. But I kind of persevered through because I felt like I needed to know what I'm doing before I start making all these messy rule-breaking. So I graduated with my commercial degree. I photographed for Safeway and Mervyn's and Gottschalk's and, you know, all this commercial stuff, photographing product.
Got to pay the bills, right?
Got to pay the bills. And it was funny because it was like, I was a professional photographer now, and I have a 401k, and I have, like, this career, right? But I was photographing turkey necks and Coca-Cola bottles and coffee urns. And that coffee urn, I photographed this 3-foot cylinder mirror that, you know, it's a coffee urn. And that day, when I photographed it and I lit it to the point that it looked better than the box it came in, that was the day I said to myself, no one's going to tell me what I'm doing wrong anymore. And then when I moved to New York, I arrived in New York a week after the towers fell.
Oh, wow.
So all my photo connections, all my freelance jobs were gone. And I had found myself at this, like, creative impasse where I felt like I couldn't take a picture unless it was going to, quote-unquote, fit in my portfolio. So I never took these pictures because I was always, oh, that picture's not good enough. That picture's not good enough for me to take. So there's all these lost memories. And I started taking pictures with my flip phone, of all things. And that's when I just started taking pictures of things that caught my interest. After a while, that rekindled my love of photography, the craft, the art of it.
Right.
I like to call it, like, what's your piece of candy? It's a non sequitur, but it's this idea that you follow what you love with abandon to the point that you are with blinders on. And when I allowed myself to work with my personal, you know, gut instinct instead of worrying about what my teachers would have said or what the Rolling Stone magazine might say about my portfolio, that's when it really became like, I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing. And to be specific, what I'm doing is I'm picking through the scraps of photography, both in theory and in medium. And as the image slides further from the medium with billions of images on Instagram, on Flickr, et cetera, but these chemicals, these papers, these arcane techniques of making images are left in the scrap heap. And to bring it back to this show specifically, one of the things that inspired me for this particular body of work was the word cochinadas, which is my female partner constantly tells her son, don't make cochinadas. And when I looked this up, the translation for it, it was filthy, dirty, unpleasant. And, you know, I heard rumors of Kodak polluting certain rivers and countries and whatnot. But because it didn't really affect me, you know, I didn't really kind of look into it. But because of this idea of mess and photography and thinking about the medium in a critical way, looking at what's left, I looked up the toxic footprint of Kodak, and they've been polluting the Genesee River. They've been under legal scrutiny since the 80s and presumably been polluting for a century because they've been set up since early 1900s.
Hmm.
Now, with that said, I had this really nice paper, you know, old, classic, fiber-based paper, you know, Agfa, Ilford, Kodak, somebody who donated his, like, collection to me. Oh, maybe the students could use it, whatever. So I felt tremendous guilt as I'm pulling them out, like mashing them through a sewing machine, dousing them with developer in real messy way, as opposed to like the controlled way of working in a dark room.
Sure.
And I thought, oh my God, what a waste. And then I thought, all those years I've been programmed to the zone system, what a waste about all these children's lives. I feel it's disingenuous to try to make beautiful landscape pictures with a medium that has been actively destroying the land. And that's really the underlying point of my particular side of this exhibition.
I'm Rick Dulock. You're listening to KVC Arts. I'm speaking with Andrew K. Thompson. The exhibition, Gray is the Color of Theory. More on the exhibition in a moment. Andrew, this is a two-person exhibition. Can you share a little bit about your partner in the exhibition, her preferred medium, and how your art connects for this show?
Yes. Her name is Sapira Chuk, and we both went to Cal State San Bernardino, the grad department. You know, we both got our MFAs. I got mine the year before hers. So Sapir and I have been friends because of the program, and she also went to UCR, so she's has Inland Empire connections. Her work focuses on Chinese brush painting tradition, and She uses the Chinese brush strokes, these performative brush strokes, to, instead of illustrating a figure's feature and thereby imposing a single narrative of the body, abstract forms of watery mass are used to draw the viewer into many possible dialogues about the figures depicted. She focuses on female bodies and female experience, the ontology of being female, and she's using the Chinese brush tradition, which is often repressive towards female bodies and experiences. And the way that they connect is that the aesthetics is very similar in the sense that we both have this gray, black, white, dripping, sort of seeping, watery, pooling appearance.
Okay.
So in a way, we look very similar. In fact, one of the striking parallels is that Sapira has in the exhibition this giant scroll. It must be 50 feet long and maybe 4 feet wide, give or take. I didn't measure it. And I also, without knowing that she was making a scroll, I had a scroll of 15 or more 8x10 sheets of paper sewn together that start with this expressive kind of drippy mess that then ends with traces of leaves and other plant life that harkens back to, you know, traditional landscape photography in air quotes,
okay,
but also somebody as early as Henry Fox Talbot with his pencil of nature early photographs. So it's like we mirror each other without actually working on the same themes.
Right.
She has her theme, women's bodies and sexuality. I have my theme, photography, critical landscape, but the aesthetics have similar quality to them.
Huh. Interesting.
It's very organic in its way.
Very interesting. So yes. Andrew K. Thompson and Sapira Chuk, a two-person exhibition, Gray is the Color of Theory, is in the Clara and Allen Gresham Art Gallery presently on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College. On August 23rd, the reception will take place. That's from 5 to 7 p.m. on August 23rd. You can find out more at valleycollege.edu/art gallery. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the call today.
Thank you, Rick. I really appreciate your interest.
I hope I'll see you over there at the opening.
You definitely will. I look forward to it.
All right. Take care.
You're listening to KBC Arts on 91.9 KBCR. I'm David Fleming. Running each Thursday through August 24th, we have the Blue Jay Jazz Festival. We had the King Brothers on the 10th, Greg Adams and East Bay Soul on the 17th, and closing on the 24th, Adriana Marie and her Groove Cutters. Their latest release, Kingdom of Swing.
There was a place called Palomar. Could they dance, boy, and how? 40 cents for the Jackson Queen. Kirk Murray got the Kingdom of Swing.
For Kingdom of Swing, then, as an album, 6 of the 14 tracks you wrote, you and or your partner L.A. Jones, were there originals on the previous Double Crossing Blues?
You know, there were no originals. That was completely an album of covers, albeit chestnuts, you know, from that era of music.
Yeah.
Fairly unpopular covers, with the exception of one or two.
Swing, listen now. Good man Benny, he was a king. A count named Basie could tickle the keys. Duke named Ellington led to please. More fun than you've ever seen.
An interesting thing,
please.
The title track, Kingdom of Swing, I actually wrote in high school.
Really? Really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well,
yep.
I'll go right into it. No question at all about this one being the title track. In it, we have mentions of Duke Ellington, Basie, Benny Goodman, the King of Swing, and then introducing yourself at the end. I'm Adriana Marie.
I know.
So,
I name-checked myself. Yeah, it just sort of worked out. That part was an afterthought. But, yeah, it was a project my junior year in high school from my musical teacher, theater teacher in high school. And we had been studying that era of music on and off for the last couple of years in school and had put on a couple of productions. And that year, our assignment was to write an original tune based on how those artists that we had been studying, Duke and, you know, all those swing era greats, influenced us, or a tribute to them of sorts. So that was what I wrote, and it's been sitting around collecting dust till this record.
Really? You didn't break it out until this?
No.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I actually have quite a big library of unpublished early writings, so there'll be more.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, that's something to look forward to. That means there's fodder for new discs left and right, as long as they fit together.
There are.
Out at the Kingdom of Swing. Now here's my story, my right to introduce my fellows. I must, they are the juice, bringing you a bit of history. I am Adrienne Marie. Oh, at the Kingdom of Swing.
With this one being an introduction to yourself at the tag at the end, this could easily be a typical opener when you're introducing the band, although for that matter, I guess it could be a great typical closer for the same reason. Do you have any tendency with this song? Do you like to burst out with this one?
Usually, you know what? This band, it's, you know, AJ Anna Marie, and on the record, her room full of all-stars, but when we're out performing it and her groove cutters, I'm so proud of my band. You know, it's a lot like Duke and Basie in the sense that the musicians that make up the band are so celebrated. There really isn't a spotlight on any one person. We always start every set with an instrumental or two because I feel it's such a beautiful thing to showcase the band.
Absolutely.
First. And so we always do that. But for this tour, since this record has come out, we always start the first vocal number of the first set is Kingdom of Swing.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It felt like an opener.
It is.
But it wasn't written for that purpose. This was a high school thing.
Mm-mm.
Were there any parameters given to you as a junior in high school when you were doing this?
Yes and no. You have to realize my parents were in the music business and performers. And so I've been steeped in this since before I could even remember. My first conscious memories are performing. So by the time I was a junior in high school, I had been studying voice for years and dance and acting, and I was doing summer stock theater.
Oh, yeah, so you'd already done summer stock by then.
I was getting influences from so many places and was already pretty far along in the process that my creative juices were flowing so heavily by that point that I didn't need a lot of parameters. They were fairly loose. Some of the projects that got turned in were more tried and simple. Mine, you know, was a little bit fancier.
Okay. Humbly stated. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Let's go back to the disc in a second, but let's talk about your childhood. Yeah. Oh, my gosh, that sounded like a psychologist statement. But okay.
I know it did. Yeah.
How do you feel about that? You were born into a performing family. We were just alluding to this. Tell me about the Carol Lee Singers. Is this different than the Carol Space Lee Singers of the Grand Ole Opry?
Yes.
Okay.
Different than them. The Carol Lee Singers was a folk group which consisted of my father and my mother and a guy by the name of Liam Al-Dubi. And he was actually Israeli, but also a U.S. citizen. And he was the deep, you know, baritone voice in the trio. And my father played guitar and sang, typical Peter Paul and Mary Kingston trio type harmonies. And my mother, who played a little guitar but mostly sang. And they were together before I was born. And my older sister got exposed to the earlier stuff that they did. And then I was born. They performed, they traveled around in a van on the Eastern Seaboard, a Volkswagen van again.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
A Volkswagen van.
Yep.
And they dragged me around everywhere, and I can remember as a toddler going to coffee houses and farms where they were having a folk festival out in the middle of a cow field and, you know, all over the place. So I have a lot of early memories of watching what they did, and then we were at a folk festival in Putney, Vermont, and I remember looking. There was this kind of a makeshift stage set up and tons of people's blankets, you know, all kinds of stuff. And on the break, they came back, and my aunt was with us on this particular occasion, and I guess she was watching me, you know, keeping an eye on me. And I can remember asking my mom, like, why are all these people here? Like, I didn't get it. You know, why are all these people here? Why do they come? So, you know, I got that at a very early age. And our house was the same way. It was just, I mean, it was almost like a musician's flop house. It was just a constant flow of people with guitars and instruments and drums and things, you know, coming through all the time. Got my eye on you. You better be well.
That's Adriana Marie closing out this year's Blue Jay Jazz Festival. More at adrianamariemusic.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. What did you learn about life on the road, as a child on the road? And also, I guess, attached to that, was this also about when you were starting to get a bit of the bug, more of a desire to do this kind of thing?
Yes, and it's funny because as that kind of consciousness came to be and I was watching this happen, by the time I was, I'm going to say 6 or 7, and my parents were very into exposing us to all forms of art, performing arts, and also the physical arts, the fine arts. We would go to any show that came into town or close by. We would go to musicals, operas, and my grandparents were also very big supporters of the arts. So I got to see so many things, and we would always buy whatever vinyl or media, 8-track tape or whatever, yep, you know, that was put out by the show. And I would play them, and I would memorize them, and I can remember, I must have been 6 or 7, my parents' friends would be coming over for dinner and music, you know, musician friends.
Yeah.
And I started putting on shows, elaborate 2-act shows from whatever input I had just received, you know, whether it was Hair. I mean, I was like performing Hair, you know, because my grandparents took me to see Hair and I loved the music.
Nice.
Or my mom took me to a Roberta Flack concert and I was like singing Roberta Flack songs, you know.
Oh, wow.
For whoever came over. So, yeah, I did get the bug very early on, and I used to perform for whoever would listen. Whoever came to our house, they were going to get a show from me. It's kind of the standing joke in our family.
Do you remember what it was that really grabbed you, whether it's the applause or the outfits or, gosh, the sheer amount of talent just wandering around every corner?
I think I really loved the affirmation. I liked making people smile, laugh, whatever it was. I loved getting a reaction out of people. That was priceless,
you know?
I remember the exact moment that I absolutely knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was going to do this all my life.
Oh, yeah?
For a living or whatever. One of the earlier musicals I was in, we were doing Oklahoma one year, and I got the role of 8-0 Annie. It was kind of my first big role. And I sang one of the songs from the show. And I didn't usually get nervous. I was nervous. I finished singing the song, and it was quiet for a moment, and the entire theater stood up on their feet and just roared, just clapped and roared, and that was it. I was just, I couldn't believe it.
Nice.
That was it. That was the moment that I knew.
That's the kind of thing that would grab you.
That's what I was going to do.
Yeah. You mentioned Summerstock Theater early, starting at age 10. You ended up doing some off-Broadway performances as well. I'd love to hear about this.
Yeah, my sister, this was kind of an interesting connection. My sister was a model in New York, in Manhattan, during that period of time, my oldest sister, and she worked for Zoli. First Ford and then Zoli, a couple of good agencies, and her husband was an entertainment lawyer, and so I used to go into New York and visit them. He introduced me to, oh my gosh, so many people in the industry, and I ended up getting just plugged in at a very early age into modeling and into theater down in Greenwich Village.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was an interesting set of years. I would go in and nothing big, small roles, extra type roles, but nonetheless, I was, you know, immersed in the whole theater environment in Greenwich Village and also doing runway modeling because I was so tall and lanky in my early years of high school. So it was quite an experience.
Wow. And you were actually living in Connecticut, is that where you were actually
here? Yes, and I had a subway pass. I mean, I was gone a lot. A lot.
I'd say.
I was a gypsy. And it's funny, you asked me a question. You said, was there one thing that I gathered as a little kid, you know, traveling around with my parents in this van? And there is. There's one thing that stuck with me my whole life, and it's kind of even become more that way the older I've gotten.
Oh, nice.
Is that home is really wherever you hang your hat. And that taught me a type of adaptability that most people, I think, don't ever get the opportunity to develop. Because of that lifestyle, I really, you know, because there's a lot of uncomfortableness and a lot of moving. Stuff is always in motion, and you have to find a way to just find some peace and relax in the midst of all that with your environment constantly changing.
Wow.
You know, and my experiences in New York and traveling and theater and dance here and modeling there and, you know, being everywhere also gave me that sense, and also a sense that I could do all of that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, some people can only handle so much on their plate.
Sure.
They have this idea like, well, I can humanly do this and that and this. And I had the idea, you know, and sometimes it's a curse as well as a blessing, but I got the sense at a very young age that there was almost no limit to the things that you could do, you know, all at once.
Something else that I read, again, another early memory, but not quite so early as childhood. I read that a vocal coach at one point started sneaking into jazz and blues clubs for inspiration.
Yeah, same one who assigned me the assignment.
Ah, same
where
one.
Where I wrote Kingdom of Swing.
Oh,
she
cool.
was Fran. She was pretty crazy. Yeah, okay. I look back and I think, how did she not get arrested?
Yeah. Well, regarding some of those clubs, those dark and smoky clubs, that is something that I also want to know. If you recall, what was your first memory, if you can, about one of those clubs? And this could be about a performer you saw, or even how you saw folks reacting to the performer. Could be that sort of thing.
It was a club in probably one of the worst parts of Bridgeport, Connecticut, you could imagine.
Of course.
Just an old bar, red vinyl, plastic booths, and a long bar and a tiny little stage at one end. People smoking and drinking, it just reeked.
Mm.
And drug dealers and the addicts, you know, on the streets.
Oh, my gosh.
We parked kind of far away and walked in, me and Fran, my vocal coach. I will not give her a last name out of courtesy. I don't even know if she's still alive. And one other student who she had sort of taken under her wing, like me, who was just, you know, a sponge, really hungry to learn everything we could from her. And we went into this club, and there was a guy, black guy, older black guy, I'll never forget his hands, just playing his guitar. Kind of Delta-type blues with a little bit of soul mixed in. I remember him doing an Otis Redding song also. And I just, oh my gosh, I don't know, somehow I related to him, and I felt like, I'm like you. You know, I just got this sense like, oh my gosh, I could just so relate to him. And I wondered about his story. You know, I've been told by a lot of people, well, you have such an old soul.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah, I did, even as a kid.
Feels like it, yeah.
I wanted to hang out with people who were older than me. I was not afraid to talk to grown-ups and older people. And I just saw this guy and listened to him, and I was so taken with him. Couldn't believe it. And he was just some old drunk guy sitting on a stool with his guitar. Probably wasn't even very good, analytically speaking. You know, I don't know.
But there's
but
presence.
But he sure moved me.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Back now to Adriana Marie. Adriana Marie and her Groove Cutters will be closing out this year's Blue Jay Jazz Festival. Her most recent disc, Kingdom of Swing. Let's go back to Kingdom of Swing. And on this disc, I never thought that I would see a fresh approach to After Hours, the Avery Parrish tune.
Yeah.
And here I did. I'm not sure what it was in the beginning that set it apart, but it sure does. Who was responsible for how this one came out?
My husband wrote the arrangement.
Okay,
L.A. wrote
LA.
The arrangement. And it's sort of a melding of the Pee Wee Crayton version mixed with, another version. I can't remember whose it was.
Buck Clayton, by chance?
He, yes.
Hey, cool. Yes. That's my favorite.
Yeah. And he just has been listening and doing this song for so long. And, you know, it was like, there was no question we were going to do an instrumental on this album, like
yes.
we did on the last one, especially with this great band, you know. And so he worked really hard coming up with an original arrangement for it. I'm glad you like it.
Well, other tunes on this disc, on Kingdom of Swing, talk to me about the selection process. I mean, as far as a well-known standard, you do include Mood Indigo, but the others...
It's my favorite jazz tune. My favorite Ellington tune ever written.
Yeah?
My mother used to sing it to me when I was a little girl.
Wow.
Yep. Love this one. Been hearing it my whole life. Yvonne's version, the lady who sang with the Ellington version. Have you heard hers? That Mood Indigo version? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The other tunes on here, let's go right to this one. I can't remember if this was Count Basie's 1 o'clock jump or Harry James' 2 o'clock jump, but the story goes that, let's just say Basie's band was playing it. He was asked what it was called. He looked at his watch and said, well, 1 o'clock jump. So is this the case with your 3 a.m. blues by chance, or did I miss a lyric in there that would have explained
it? No, 3 a.m. blues is really a blues that I actually wrote at 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's
where the name came from.
It really is.
I wrote that tune in the winter that I first moved up to Lake Arrowhead. It's a blues, and I wrote it in the middle of the night. It came to me, and I leapt out of bed, and I went in the other room, and my husband came in, and he goes, what's the matter? Are you okay? And I said, get out.
Oh, that's another one.
Get out, I'm writing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Again, several originals on here. It's a really nice, seamless blend. If a person doesn't know better, they may not even realize what was written maybe just a couple of weeks ago or a year ago versus something that came to us from 1932 or something like that.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if there are any tunes recorded or maybe even about to be recorded that, let's say you just sing around the house and L.A. comes up and says, man, we got to record that. He just loves the textures that you throw into it, the flavor. Anything like that? Or was that Mood Indigo?
Since moving up here, which it'll be 3 years this November, we lovingly call our house, and it got the name quite quickly, Birdland.
Oh, okay.
So much so that we have a sign on our front door that says Birdland and has the original Birdland logo because L.A. is an absolute Charlie Parker fanatic.
Yeah.
And we both grew up on the East Coast. So anyway, it's kind of this double entendre because we live up in this little chalet up on this mountain. So anyway, but the point I'm bringing this up is that we play nearly every evening at Birdland. And we actually have a jam, I don't know, a couple of times a month where some of our local musicians and jazz friends come over and we play. So there's a lot of music. The apple didn't fall far from the tree.
Sweet.
You know, with my folks, we do this a lot. And we are already working on material and have been for about 4 or 5 months for the next record, which we're due to record early in the year.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because one thing I've learned, I know a lot of people, they do a record like Kingdom of Swing or whatever their particular Kingdom of Swing is, and they have all this creativity and stuff that goes into it, and then they feel like they have to get another record out, and they maybe grab stuff that really isn't stuff they really, really love to do or are super artistically and emotionally invested in. And to me, that comes across. I've heard some of my friends, and I've heard other records, and I'm like, you know, they're not invested in this song. I just get that sense. And I've been lucky that we've had songs and material that's been original and otherwise that we're all, particularly L.A. and I, super invested in.
Long blue.
I know that you listened to a lot of Basie, some early Basie with the Helen Hume stuff and all that.
She was a wonderful songwriter. Most people don't know that. You know, they just know the her that, you know, Basie discovered. But she was a great, great songwriter.
I did not know that, no.
Yes, and you know, he controlled much of her career for a good portion of it, and she wrote a lot. Didn't always get to, you know, perform what she wrote. But yeah, she was a prolific and wonderful songwriter. Of all the female artists that have influenced me, she really had one foot in the jazz world and one foot in the blues realm. Deep blues. So that's pretty cool.
I'm a high-powered mama. I'm just raring to go.
That's Adriana Marie, closing out this year's Blue Jay Jazz Festival. More at adrianamariemusic.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. We were talking a lot about the original tunes on Kingdom of Swing and talking about some of the standards as well. There seems to be a wonderful bit of storytelling to your lyrics, not just always falling into the trappings of an all-too-typical blues style of writing.
If I could take you back in the day when cats would jump and the room would sway, horns a-blazing, sounds amazing, man, you'd like it that way.
But now with Gimme a Roomful, for example, is that quite literally thinking about wanting to pack him in like Duke Ellington? There is a phrase in there alluding to that.
It's a song I wrote, again, a bit of a double meaning there, yes. And, okay. I mean, it's a tribute to the music of that era and Give Me a Roomful, yes, a roomful of players who can really pull him in, pack him in, light the stage on fire, you know, blow their horns and light up the night. But also a tribute to Roomful of Blues.
Okay.
Because we both grew up in Connecticut. L.A. and I did both, and both grew up listening to Roomful of Blues. And so Duke Robillard and that band, especially the early incarnation, not the present one, are heroes of sorts. And they were, I think most blues reviewers, historians would agree that they're kind of responsible for the jump blues revival of the 60s, that band.
Okay.
So that song is a tribute to them and also to the music.
One more thing before we leave Kingdom of Swing. This was produced by Duke Robillard, or at least one or two tracks.
Indeed.
What was his involvement? Yeah, okay, so he was the overall producer.
No, he produced the whole record. We actually flew back east, and L.A. and I had been, when we were at the point where we were talking about our follow-up to Double Crossing Blues, one of the ideas that came up was that we wanted to do kind of a Roomful tribute, that we wanted to hire some of the guys from Roomful. And I said, well, why don't we ask Duke to produce it? And he goes, well, I don't know him. And I said, well, I'm going to get his phone number and I'm going to call him and ask him.
Good for you.
And I did. And he just loved the idea, and it all came together. And we flew back east and recorded it at this amazing studio about a half hour outside of Roomful territory, you know. Yeah, and he guests on a couple tracks. He would have actually been on more of the record, but he had just had shoulder surgery about 6 weeks prior, and he had such limited range of movement and was still in quite a bit of pain. He actually tracked a couple more songs, but we ended up not using him because he just wasn't recovered enough to play.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's really cool that you got to not only have him as a producer, but to be able to talk to him and interact with him, since he was one of those folks that you drew inspiration from. That's great.
Yeah, I know. It was like a dream come true. And Ella and I got married the week after we recorded the record.
Oh, cool. Okay.
That piece, yeah. So nice. It was, you know, it's memorable in so many ways. Sort of an interesting.
Jump back, Jack. Give me a room for some. Make it cool. Make it hot. Babies, give it all you got. Play the sweetest melody. Jump back, Jack. And play it for me. Jump back, Jack. And play it for me.
After after invading your Facebook page, I saw you with a stand-up bass, double bass, yeah. And other times electric. Do you typically play in performance settings, or are you just totally up there on the mic?
I do both. It depends on the gig. It depends on the budget of the show producer and what they're looking for. It just depends. Like, you'll see at Blue Jay Jazz, I'm going to be playing double bass because we want to have four horns, and the budget is small. They don't have a lot of money. So because we have horn charts that are written for three, four, five parts, if I have to hire a bass player, it's like we have one less horn sometimes.
Okay.
So it just depends. And we also do a trio and a little quartet thing just with one horn, a little small ensemble combo thing. So it really just depends on the gig.
Okay.
Yeah.
How does a person like yourself, you love this music, you grew up on it, whether it was your parents' vinyl or your vinyl later on, how do you end up making sure that you are paying both tribute, but also making sure to have your own signature on it, your own flavor?
Yeah, that's an interesting, yeah. That's something I've sort of paid attention to for a long, long time, and it's actually something my parents impressed upon me early. My vocal coaches, my acting coaches, you know, find out who you are. Take this point of reference or whatever it is, whether it's written or it's, you know, music or whatever, and figure out a way to make it yours. Find your own voice. And one of the first reviews that I got, and actually he ended up writing the liner notes for Double Crossing Blues, he wrote it, he said it, and I was like, oh my gosh, it made me realize that's what I've tried to do, and wow, maybe I might have actually found this. He wrote, and I quote, he said, Adrianna Marie sings without affectation. And that is a very elusive and difficult thing to do when you hear someone like, and I love Esther Phillips so much. You have no idea. Like, I go to her gravestone every once in a while when I'm in the area in L.A. I adore her music, her whole career, and her life story I find very interesting as well. But you listen to someone like that, like Cherry Wine, and you think, I just remind myself, you know, as I'm trying to find my own voice and we start working up the material, I'm not trying to be anybody else or sound like anybody else. I really am trying to just stick with, refine, and hone me. And everybody in the band actually does that, and it just happens naturally.
Sure.
Because they all have such eclectic backgrounds and musical influences, we can take whatever the song is, and their own sense of style can't help but be infused in it. And the end product is just this big melting pot, you know, of all of our experiences and our sounds.
Beautiful.
So it ends up being unique. If I were trying to sing with affectation, and I know people who do it and they do it amazingly. I mean, I know people who sound like Billie Holiday or, you know, Etta James or whatever.
Sure.
I know a guy, he's from Israel, and he barely speaks English, and he does all this B.B. King stuff, and I swear to God, if you closed your eyes, you would think it's B.B. King. I kid you not. He does it so well, but he's completely singing with affectation.
Yeah.
And it's great, but it's not his own.
Yeah.
Just a great emulator, you know, and that works for him. He has a great record on a great label, and he plays all over and gets bookings because people want to hear it. Yeah. I have to remind myself not to compromise that. You know, you get great reviews, and you get mediocre reviews, fence-sitting reviews, and then you get some that where they're just kind of like, eh, I don't really get it, right?
Yeah.
So this one guy reviewed Kingdom of Swing, and we've gotten mostly great raving reviews from that record.
I would
it's
think.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful record.
Sure is.
But, you know, he compared me. He said, well, you know, Better Beware and the Billie Holiday tune, Blueser Brew. And I was like, that's a Louis Armstrong tune, but okay. You know. And he said, yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of people try it, and they're just okay.
Well.
You know, and that's okay. That's okay. I love hearing those as well. But it reminds me that you can't please everybody, and what's most important is to just be you.
I didn't hear you trying to sound like somebody else. The most trying to sound that I heard of anything was that is you and the band and I think this comes through on both discs, but especially on the Kingdom of Swing album, what I heard was an effort to sound like it was long ago. And you were even using ribbon mics and just older type of stuff, weren't you?
Yes, absolutely. The first record, we actually recorded all on tape.
Mm.
And LA has a beautiful arsenal of vintage guitars, 40s D'Angelicos and, you know, Gibsons. And he plays those, and vintage amps as well. And he's played only vintage instruments on the record. So, yeah, that was important to us. You know, we're not trying to be a 40s shtick band.
Right, good.
That's not what we're doing at all. We love that music. And certain aspects of that sound we are trying to recreate in some way, or preserve would be a better word, but we absolutely are trying to make it ours.
Yes. Again, it comes across as something your own. It doesn't sound like you're trying to be something other than yourself and having fun with what is clearly a love of a certain type of music. The Kingdom of Swing as a new release. That actually just came out.
It did. It hit actually the last week of March. And do you know, we have been number one on the Jazzy Blues Roots Music Report since it hit.
Oh.
This Monday, if we get it again, will be 20 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
Oh wow.
Shocking.
Well, congratulations. This is, people don't usually go up to Lake Arrowhead to start recording number one stuff.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, right?
Wow.
I mean, in the blues world, you know, it's not like it's Billboard charts, but it's certainly an accomplishment in our genre. So.
You got that right. Yeah. That's Adriana Marie closing out this year's Blue Jay Jazz Festival, August 24th. More at AdrianaMarieMusic.com. More on the festival at BlueJayJazz.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Adriana Marie and to Blue Jay Jazz board member Christopher Gross. Thanks also to Andrew K. Thompson, part of the two-person exhibit Gray is the Color of Theory. That's at Gresham Art Gallery on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College, and the opening reception coming up August 23rd. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Izzy Gordon. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.